My name is Bhante Sujato, for those of you who don't know me. I have the privilege of doing the Sutta class for this afternoon. Have you got the copies of the Sutta? Lynn made some copies, yeah? You managed to get all the way through to the end? I decided to make it a really challenging one for this afternoon. What time? We normally finish up about 4:30, is that right? Something like that? Okay, because for this afternoon I also wanted to discuss with you about the early Buddhism course. So some of you may have heard the other night when I talked about we're doing putting on an early Buddhism course. And so we still haven't finalized the timing of that. There's various issues regarding the timing of the early Buddhism course. So I wanted to consult with you beforehand to see whether anybody in this class was going to be interested to do that course and or not, and if so, how that might affect our choice of timing and so on. But anyway, we might have a look at the sutta first, and then we can talk about that a bit later on. Okay, so the sutta for this week I chose is one in the Saggatavagga of the Sanghita Nikaya, and it's called None Equal to That of a Son. And the very short sutta and very simple one, but has a number of very interesting features to it, which is the reason why it came to my attention. I was looking for a sutta to read for the class yesterday, and this one came to my attention, and I thought that might be interesting and a little bit different. So, the sutta as it's given here in Bhikkhu Bodhi's translation, at Savatthi, standing to one side, that Devata spoke this verse in the presence of the Blessed One. There is no affection like that for a son, no wealth equal to cattle. There is no light like the sun among the waters, the ocean is supreme. And the Buddha then replied, there is no affection like that for oneself, no wealth equal to grain. There is no light like wisdom. Among the waters, the rain is supreme. Now, one of the reasons why I found this sort of be quite interesting, because I thought it was quite, some of the Buddha's replies there were sort of a bit unusual. I wasn't quite sure, why is the Buddha saying grain is better than cattle, for example? Seems a bit an odd thing for the Buddha to say, doesn't it? Yeah. Why does he say the rain is better than the oceans? It's also a bit odd, isn't it? So, often when you find these things in the suttas, then they repay careful attention and consideration and reflection, because often it's a sign that there's something there that you don't understand, and something which bears further investigation and inquiry. So what I might do is just offer some reflections about this and some suggestions as to what exactly is going on in this somewhat unusual exchange. First thing to understand about it is its location. The particular sutta is in the Saggatavagga, as I just mentioned, the chapter or the section with verses of the Sanyutta Nikaya. Now, I understand most of the readings that we've done in the sutta class here usually from the Majjhima Nikaya, but hopefully, do most of you have some familiarity with the Sanyutta Nikaya? Yes? No? No? Yes? No? Okay, right, okay. Good, okay. So the Sanghita Nikaya, of course, in the Buddhist collection of suttas, there's five main collections: the long discourses, middle discourses, connected discourses, numerical discourses, and the minor collection. And this is one of those five collections, the connected discourses, Sanghita. And what the word connected means usually is that they're grouped according to topic. Okay? So in the Sanyutta Nikaya, you typically find groups of all the suttas dealing with the five khandhas, the five aggregates, all the suttas dealing with dependent origination, all the suttas dealing with the Eightfold Path, and so on and so forth. So all of those main central Dhamma topics, which are taught again and again and again in the Buddha's life, are collected and they're put into one collection here. Now, that's a very methodical way of doing things. And you can understand how that way of doing things is very useful, especially from the point of view of an oral tradition. Okay, now with an oral tradition, you have to memorize all of these suttas, right? And it's obviously easier to memorize if you have 100 suttas which share a lot of things in common. Okay, and then you only have to learn a bit extra for the next one. Okay, and it's interesting. These are some of the basic principles of information technology. Is that if you work in IT, you know, the kind of rule number one is backup. It doesn't exist if it's not backed up, right? So that's what the Buddha did with his suttas all the time, is backups to everything, right? So if you lose one sutta, it doesn't matter all that much because there's a dozen suttas that are pretty much the same, yeah? So when we read it as a written text, we think it sounds a bit boring, right? Because they're just saying the same thing. Why are they just saying the same thing again and again? Another important point with information technology is compressibility. And it's related to this idea of things being repeated and being redundant. So you can compress them. So you can express the same thing in a very short form or expand it to a very large form. And again, we find this feature very much throughout the Dhamma, that you can express things in a very short way and you can take it out, you can express the same pattern over a very long form. So this is the kind of thing that we find throughout the Sanyutta Nikaya. However, an exception to that, a partial exception to that, is the first section of the Sanyutta Nikaya, which is called the Saggata Wagga. Because the Saggata Wagga is not, on the surface of it, collected according to topic, like the rest of the Sanyutta is. Nor is it particularly philosophical. The rest of the Sanyutta Nikaya is very much concerned with kind of straightforward statements of Buddhist doctrine, Buddhist teachings. This is the five khandhas, this is physical form, it's impermanent, it's suffering, it's not self, and so on. And so there's all these very analytical and direct presentations of the teachings, which is characteristic of the Sanyutta Nikaya style. And with the Saggata Wagga, the first and fairly large section, we find it quite a different style, and here we find most things are in verses. Okay, so Saggata means with verse. So what that means is here that we have texts or suttas that are usually actually mixed prose and verse, so with verse rather than just being verses, yeah? Saggata. So there's some kind of prose or narrative background, and in that background there's some verses, and the main teaching is expressed in the form of verse. And the verses are, much like poetry always is not characterized by sort of detailed and explicit analysis of Buddhist teachings, but it's full of imagery, it's full of allusions, it's full of metaphors, it's full of... It evokes a kind of response. But the verse form has more to it than that, because the verse form that we're seeing here, the actual literary style of the verses, where does this way of versifying come from? Well, it comes from the Brahmanical tradition, from the text we call the Vedas. And in the Indian history, Indian literature, the oldest literature that we have is a text called the Rig Veda, which is probably about 1,000 years older than the Buddha, and is one of the oldest texts, extensive texts of any sort that exists anywhere. The Rig Veda consists mainly of hymns of praise, invocation, and so on to various gods, deities, and it's all expressed in terms of verse. And those verse styles which we find in the Rig Veda passed down through the Indian tradition and were adopted by pretty much everyone, but were also adopted by the Buddhists for their verse expression. Now, one of the results of that, or one of the characteristics of verses in the Buddhist tradition, is that often, not always, but often, we find that verses are especially prominent in Brahmanical contexts. Okay, so in contexts where the Buddha was engaged with and discussing with the Brahmins or the other representatives of the religious culture in which the Buddha found himself. Okay, this is a very, very important point. If we look in Buddhist literature, all down through the years, okay, every kind of Buddhist literature, from the Abhidhamma, Mahayana sutras, the various shastras and treaties, right down to the modern day, and we look at the vast majority of meditation books and so on and so forth, the vast majority of Buddhist literature is Buddhists talking to other Buddhists, like I'm doing here, right? Most of you probably Buddhist, or at least reasonably sympathetic to Buddhism, right? And that's the majority of teaching. Now, occasionally I might go and do an interfaith talk or something like that, or there'll be some non-Buddhists and we'll have a discussion and so on. So that happens, certainly here in Australia, it happens a reasonable amount. However, if I was, say, in Sri Lanka or in Thailand or in Burma, that would happen very, very rarely, okay? It would be very exceptional to give a talk to anybody other than Buddhists. And yet what we find in the Buddhist suttas is the Buddha is talking to non-Buddhists all the time, right? He's constantly having dialogues with people who didn't believe what he was saying, who were challenging him, who were presenting him with a different point of view and getting him to respond to it. We find this all the way through the Digha Nikaya, almost most of the suttas in the Digha Nikaya, many of the suttas in the Majjhima, and it's very characteristic here in the Saggatawagga as well. So this is a literary form which is being adopted and which represents the juxtaposition of different values, different religious ideas, different ways of seeing the world, and the Buddha is responding to those things. Now, the Saggatawagga as a whole features this kind of thing very prominently, and we find in the Saggatawagga, we find characters like Brahma, the god of the Hindus and the Brahmins, obviously. We find the Brahmana Sanghita with the Brahmin priests in dialogue with the Buddha. We find the Saka Sanghita, which has Indra, the god of the one of the main gods in the Rig Veda, who is in dialogue with the Buddha. And of course, in each of these cases, we find that what happens is that the characteristics that have been brought down or passed down in the tradition are taken by the Buddha and transformed in his own very particular way and given a new slant on things. I'll just give one example of that. Let's see if I can find the sutta just quickly. Okay, so here's a sutta called the bird nests. This is from the Sakka Sanghita. Sakka is the name usually given in Buddhist texts to the god called Indra. Indra being the ferocious, thunder-wielding, dragon-slaying lord of the Rig Veda. He's like the tough guy in the suit of armor who goes around killing things and he's like the kind of the He's the Terminator of the Rig Veda. He's like the Arnold Schwarzenegger character, right? So you've got to understand, this is this guy, right, who you expect to sort of walk into the battlefield and slay everybody with his thunderbolt, right? And so this is the story. And the archetypal battle is between the Devas, the gods, and the Asuras. Actually, Indra's personal battle is between him and Vritra, the serpent. But For the collective battle is between the Devas and the Asuras. It's the gods and the titans in Greek mythology. Because once in the past, the Devas and the Asuras were arrayed for battle. In that battle, the Asuras won, that is, the bad guys won, and the Devas were defeated. Indra, of course, being the leader of the Devas. In defeat, the Devas withdrew towards the north while the Asuras pursued them. And then Sakka, the lord of the gods, addressed his charioteer, Matali, in verse. Okay, so here, as always, you find the central message is in the verses. Avoid, O Martali, with your chariot pole, the bird nests in the silk cotton woods. Let's surrender our lives to the Asuras rather than make these birds nestless. Okay? So this is like the Terminator now saying that, well, let's not charge into this forest because we might destroy the birds' nests. Okay? And so Martali, the charioteer, says to him, yes, your lordship. And he turned back the chariot with its team of 1,000 thoroughbreds. And then, monks, it occurred to the Asuras. Now, Sukha's chariot with its team of 1,000 thoroughbreds has turned back. The Devas are coming back to engage with the Asuras for a second time. Stricken by fear, they returned to the city of the Asuras. In this way, Sukha, the lord of the Devas, won a victory by means of righteousness itself. I really love that story. So here's a very good example of how the Buddha took these ideas, yeah, this kind of ferocious war god of the Rig Vedas, and tamed him in such a way. He's still very recognizable, but now he wins because of his kindness for the little birdies, and he won't go into the forest because he might hurt them. But he still wins the battle. Yeah. That's very characteristic of the Buddhist approach to this kind of interfaith. It's a very kind of light-hearted approach. It's a very playful approach. And that's very, very characteristic of the way the Buddha dealt with this kind of thing. If you often find him using this kind of gentle sarcasm or irony when he's talking with people from other traditions and so on. And so humour is very much a part of that. Okay, so this is some idea of the Sagatawaga. Well, the other thing I should mention is that whereas the rest of the Sanyutta is organised, is somewhat dry, and it's organised according to doctrine. Okay, so it's according to topic. Whereas the Sagatawaga is much more playful and is organised not according to doctrine but according to person. Okay, so there's one chapter for Sakha, the king of gods, another chapter for the bhikkhus or the bhikkhunis, another chapter for the lay people, and so on and so forth. King Pasenadi has his own chapter, and so on. So it's like the different classes of people in the society in the time of the Buddha are either represented as a class or by an individual who's from that class. And so it has much more of a personal feel to it compared to the somewhat abstract and dry suttas of the most of the rest of the Sanyutta. Okay, so the part of the Sagatawaga that our sutta comes from is the first section, and it's called the Devata Sanyutta. And so this is the Sanyutta collected discourses with the Devas. Now the standard literary form of these is given in the first sutta. Thus have I heard on one occasion the Blessed One was dwelling at Savatthi in Jetta's grove in Atapindika's park. Then when the night had advanced, a certain Deva of stunning beauty, illuminating the entire Jetta's grove, approached the Blessed One. Having approached, he paid homage to him, stood to one side and said to him, and then He asks a question or says a verse, and the Buddha responds, and the Deva eventually approves and disappears right there. So this is like the standard framework for the text. Now, one thing that we need to understand and we need to be very careful of when we're reading the suttas is to be able to distinguish between the framing narrative and the text itself, okay? The text itself is the thing which is attributed to the Buddha. The framing narrative is not attributed to the Buddha. The text does not say that the Buddha said all of these things. It doesn't say that he said that there was a Deva who came down and so on and so forth. So these framing narratives are not really the sutta in the strict sense. Okay? When we use the word sutta, what we mean usually is what was spoken by the Buddha. Yeah? And what was spoken by the Buddha is the teaching, which is the core of it, and not the framing narrative. Okay? Do you understand that distinction? This is very, very important. And this is something which people, when they're reading the suttas, almost always neglect. Okay? We almost always forget that the framing narrative is something that was added by the redactors of the canon, by persons and persons unknown, time and times unknown, place or places unknown. Okay? Now, what's the purpose of this and what's going on? Well, you can see if you look at this particular set of verses that we have here, there is no affection like that of a son, no wealth equal to cattle, there's no light like the sun, among the waters the ocean is supreme. Well, why is it a deva who's saying that? Right? There's nothing particularly divine about that verse, right? It's a fairly ordinary verse. It's an expression of common values in society, right? And there's no particular reason why it has to be a god coming down and illuminating the sky and so on who's saying that. So this is just a convention. It's a literary convention that framed these kinds of verses. And the reality is, of course, you don't really know what was the context in which the original verse was spoken. But what these framing narratives do is that they help to give a structure and a definition to the text itself. Okay? What do I mean by that? Well, have a look at the text we have here. If you look at it literally, it just says Atsavati. Right? So it's already abbreviated the introduction. Yeah? What it should say is, thus have I heard. On one occasion, the Blessed One was staying in Savatthi at Jetta's Grove. But they couldn't be bothered saying all of that stuff because it gets too boring after a while. So this is that compressibility that I was talking about before. Right? You can compress it down. In Pali, that's just one word, Savatthiyam. Okay? And it assumes that it's talking about a deva. It's referring to that deva. So it's an abbreviated form. But what that does is that marks off that particular sutta. Okay? It says this is one particular unit which is distinct from another one. This is very, very important, especially if you're going to be reciting these texts in an oral tradition. You have to have something that's going to let you remember when do these things begin and when do they end. Otherwise, they just kind of munge together in your head and you can't remember which one belongs with which. Yeah. Now, if you have a look at the next suttas, it's also the next ones become even more abbreviated. Okay. Then the next one, number 14, the Katiya. It's a very similar kind of sutta, but even the very small introduction has now gone, and the murmuring one again. These ones, they lose any pretense of a framing narrative. Actually, now it's just the verses. Yeah. Or the it's been compressed so much, you just assume that the framing narrative is there. And this, of course, is a bit of a problem. In Bhikkhu Bodhi's nice translation here, he's put the numbers there and the titles and so on and so forth, but he's just made that up, right? That's not in the Pali text, that's not in the manuscript, that's not in the text as it was recited. Yeah. Now, he's made it up with good reasons. There are various kind of marks and so on that you use for doing those things. It's not just arbitrary. But they're not things that are found in the text itself. Well, say that it says number 14, bracket 4, the Katiya. So that's not in the actual text itself, so in the Pali text. Yeah? Number 26, yeah? All of those things. This gives a framework that divides one sutta from the next. Yeah. So the main point of this is that when we're reading the suttas, we should always be able to discern between the framing narrative and the main text which the Buddha said. And the purpose of the framing narrative is like covers on a book. Think of it like that. That's what the framing narrative is. It's there to protect it, to hold it, to keep it safe. Okay? So you have the Buddha's scriptures is called the Tripitaka. Yeah, the three baskets, right? I don't know if has it ever occurred to you to wonder why is it called the three baskets? Because it's an oral tradition, right? Now, baskets make sense if you've got books and you keep your books in a basket. That makes sense. But it was an oral tradition. They're memorized texts. How do you keep memorized texts in a basket? What does it mean? Yeah. So what the idea of the basket there is a metaphor for a cover or a protection. And the basket is in fact these framing narratives and all of the other means which you find through the text, whose purpose is to define and keep safe these texts. That's what a basket does, isn't it? You put something, you want to keep it safe, you want to stop it from being scattered and so on, you put it in a basket to protect it. Yeah? So each sutta, each text spoken by the Buddha is like being wrapped. So you can always see that in this collection that one sutta is like wrapped, it's almost like it's wrapped in a leaf. Right? And then you put it together with 10 other suttas, and then you wrap those 10 suttas in another leaf, which we call a wagga, 10 suttas. And then you put those suttas in another collection, you wrap that again, like a collection of 50 suttas or something like that. And then you put it in the Nikaya, and then that's wrapped again. And then you put it in the Tipitaka, in the basket, and you keep it safe. Yeah? So this is the work that was done by the redactors and the editors of the text, to put things in this form, to give it that structure and definition that would help it to survive. Now, one of the things that's interesting here, this particular sutta has two counterparts. So you haven't even started talking about the sutta itself yet. This has two counterparts, which is in Chinese translation. And I just quickly checked those two Chinese translations before I came. And one of the differences you see between them is both of the Chinese translations are very similar. Now, first of all, both of them have the complete beginning and ending. Okay, so they don't have the abbreviated form that we have here. It's all expanded. So, and that's somewhat characteristic of the Chinese translations. They often tend to spell things out a bit more than we find in the Pali tradition. The other interesting thing about them is that they both have a third verse. Okay? So they both have a verse which seems to be missing from the Pali tradition. Why is that missing? I don't really know. Is that often these verses and so on which are missing you might find elsewhere in the tradition. But you know, you can see from the fact that it's been abbreviated that it would be very easy to drop off a verse. Because notice it doesn't have the complete structure here. It's missing the ending of it, and it doesn't have the beginning of the next sutta. So there's a bit of a crumbly boundary there, and it's maybe one verse has slipped out of that crumbly boundary. That verse says something like, it's the Deva replying again to the Buddha, and it says something like, for a long time now, the Brahman, the pure one, has realized Nibbana. He has abandoned fear and hatred, and he lives compassionate for all the world. Something like that. So it's a fairly straightforward verse. There's nothing particularly striking or unusual about it, but it is interesting that both the Chinese versions have that and the Pali is missing it. Apart from that, the Chinese are very similar to the Pali. The only exception is that when the Buddha says there's no wealth equal to grain, one of the Chinese translations has there's no wealth equal to the ability to teach. That's a bit unusual, isn't it? It's a bit weird. I've got no idea why it says that. I assume it's probably a mistake in the Chinese translation, but anyway, that's the easiest assumption to make. So I won't go into that anymore. Okay, so that's the kind of the background. And now we've got through that, I'll talk about the actual sutta itself. But before we go and talk about the sutta, does anyone have any questions or comments about what I've just done, the background information? Yeah, please. Sorry? Redactor? A redactor is like an editor. Do you want to repeat? I can't. Use the mic, then we can record it. Yeah.
Why is this word being used? Is this specifically for language or this word?
Why do we use the word redactor rather than editor? I honestly don't really know. It's just the word that people use. Yeah. I mean, the work of the redactors is, like, I guess it's pretty much similar to an editor. But no, I think it's more. Yeah.
Why I'm curious is because I go through my two dictionary, I can't find it, and I'm just very curious. And my walking dictionary husband can't find it when he can read William Blake.
All right. So anyway, redactor is the name for the people who organised and put together the text, usually said to be done, first of all, at the first council after the Buddha passed away. Okay, any other questions? Yeah.
Excuse me.
I have to use a mic so that we can keep the machines happy.
Framing is...
You're right? We can hear?
This framing is consistent throughout the sutta, the Pali Canon?
It's fairly consistent, but you do find that, especially in the shorter discourses, especially in the Sanyutta and the Anguttara, that very often the framing is just left out. Now, that's the case according to the manuscript traditions that we've inherited, which are not very old. It's not clear whether that would have been the case in the oral tradition, whether if you're reciting it, you maybe just recited all the beginnings and endings. It's actually, if you are reciting suttas, it's actually quite nice to do that because it's quite kind of peaceful and restful, and, you know, it's easy to do those repeated passages at the beginning and the end. So I suspect that in the oral tradition that was done more, and that there's gradually the tendency in the written tradition has been to drop them off.
So I was thinking of the Dhammapada, for instance.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Dhammapada is another case. With the Dhammapada, what you find is that the verses don't have any framing narrative, that they're just, it's just a sequence of verses, which, I mean, is not too different from me. If you look through the Sagata Wagga, you find that, although there's quite a few prose backgrounds, but there's also quite a few pages where it's just one verse after the other. In the Dhammapada, what you'll find is that each verse is also traditionally passed down with its own background story. And even though the text itself, which we usually see today, you know, when we think of the Dhammapada, we think of a short group of verses, right? But actually in the traditional teaching, that would have almost always been taught together with the story and the background to it. So it did have a framing, but not in the same formal way. Yeah. Okay. Any other questions? Okay, very good. So now we have the exchange. Now, as I mentioned before, I don't think the fact that this is a devata saying this is particularly important, but what is more significant is that in these verses you usually find that the devata is expressing a somewhat conventional and limited set of values. And the Buddha then raises that to a higher set of values. And so this is the, you know, we find this again and again and again throughout these verses in the Sagata Wagga. I'll just give one example, just picking that at random. Here, the fourth sutta in the Sagata Wagga, the Deva says, "Time flies by, the nights swiftly pass, the stages of life successively desert us. Seeing clearly this danger in death, one should do deeds of merit that bring happiness." And the Buddha then responds, "Time flies by, the nights swiftly pass, the stages of life successively desert us. Seeing clearly this danger in death, the seeker of peace should drop the world's bait." Yeah. So the first three lines are identical. The only change is in the last line. And here the devata is expressing the worldly value. You should do deeds of merit which will lead to happiness and lead to going to heaven. Whereas the Buddha is saying, if you're really seeking peace, you should drop attachment to the world. So this is This is very typical of the way that the Buddha transforms these values. One of the curious things in this verse is that the Buddha doesn't seem to be quite transforming values in the same way. But he seems to be in some way responding to one set of worldly values with another set of worldly values. Okay, so let's have a look at what they say. There is no affection like that of a son, no wealth equal to cattle, no light like the sun. These are two different, this is sun with an O and sun with a U, of course. Among the waters, the ocean supreme. The Buddha, there's no affection like that for oneself, no wealth equal to grain, no light like wisdom. Among the waters, the rain is supreme. Okay, so let's take each one of those four things in turn and see what the implications are. So the first one, the Deva says, there's no affection like that for a son. So this, of course, is reflecting the normal spiritual values, of course, in any normal worldly values in any spirit, in any society. Of course, children are regarded as being greatly valuable, and particularly in the Brahmanical society, which existed in the time of the Buddha, the son was regarded as being of exceptional importance. That the father basically lived and found eternal life through the son, and there are many examples of this. What's interesting is that the Buddha responds by saying, "There's no affection like that for oneself." And the word for oneself, of course, is atta, yeah, oneself. Now, this is kind of curious on a number of levels. First of all, is the Buddha promoting narcissism here? Right? Now, it's actually quite an interesting point. I mean, if you look in modern spirituality, you know, you can see that the tendency very much in modern spirituality since, I guess, the 60s and 70s has been for spirituality to become much more self-centered, right? So it's all about, you know, finding oneself and purifying and so on. Whereas traditional spirituality, certainly in the West, and often in Buddhist countries as well, is much more community-orientated. Yeah? So it's about a community coming together and celebrating and sharing their values. Whereas in more recent times it's become about self-realization. Yeah? And of course any number of New Age retreats and so on and so forth, and it's all about self, self, self. So is the Buddha to blame for all this? Was the Buddha the original spiritual narcissist? And is that why Buddhism has become very popular in recent years? Because we can cater to this tendency towards spiritual narcissism. I'm just throwing that out there. Any comments or suggestions, thoughts? Why is the Buddha saying oneself? What's going on here?
What is our best refuge? It could be ourselves. Uh-huh. Well, that's just from the Dhammapada.
You seek oneself as a refuge, yeah.
Which, for me, was quite strange, I think, when I first read it. That I would be my own salvation or best refuge.
Yeah.
No one loves another like they love themselves. That fits in with that, what she said to her husband, wasn't it?
That's right. Yeah, that's right. And that's in those verses also in the Sagatawaga, so quite closely related. Yeah. Sorry. He's stating fact. Well, he's not quite just stating a fact. He's in a sense that's true. He's not saying that this should be the case. He's saying what is in fact the case. That's true. But there's also a sense, in some ways there's a sense in which there's a change of values. I mean, if you look at the third line, this is very obvious when the Deva says there's no light like the sun, and the Buddha says there's no light like wisdom. Okay? Now that's very straightforward. That's exactly the kind of thing which we would expect the Buddha to say. Right? So that's very unproblematic. And so that's why I found this verse interesting, because most of them are not like that. Most of them aren't quite what you expect the Buddha to say. Yeah. just have a look. Well, one thing that's striking about that line also is that when the Buddha says that there's no affection like that for oneself, he's using the word atta, which of course is the main philosophical core of the Brahmanical tradition. And in the Brahmanical Upanishads and other teachings, it's the self, the Atman, which is the goal, the sort of beginning and the ending of everything which is worthwhile and the values of what you're doing. And so it's here, it's like the Buddha is teaching the Atman, the self, right? The Deva isn't bringing in the Atman, the Buddha is. Right? Instead of bringing in not self, he's bringing in the self. So this, I think, is also very interesting. So I always like these ones, these suttas, that they sort of seem as if they're teaching something very radical. Let's just, before I go on to talk about that anymore, let's just have a look at the next verse. The next line, there's no wealth equal to cattle, to which the Buddha responds, there's no wealth equal to grain. Also quite interesting. It's not that normal that the Buddha kind of weighs in on agricultural policy. It meant rain. No, it doesn't mean rain, it means grain. Yeah, it's dhanya, yeah. Dhanya. So what's happening here? What's wrong with cows? Well, they do these days, but in those days they didn't. Yeah, they ate the grass. Yeah.
And they're going from the specific to the general, so that the specific thing, there's only cattle. You don't talk about all the other animals, but grain can be for human beings as well, or for feeding others, just as instead of feeding cattle.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, fair enough. Yeah?
Maybe he's just being a bit sarcastic. Like, he's just saying, you know, like, cattle, you can't have cattle without grain. And you can't have grain without water. And you can't. So he's kind of semi-pointing towards, well, what is their wealth? He's kind of sarcastically saying,
okay.
Looking at the word wealth and saying...
Yeah. Okay. Maybe there may be something to that, but in the Buddha's day, the grain, the cattle didn't eat grain. Yeah, they ate grass. So, but it's not. I don't think it's entirely wrong though. But I think I don't think it's quite hitting it. Go on, another suggestion. Head over here.
But I think grain, the connotations have to do with roots, and it go further into propagation. Whereas cattle just eat and meat and once it's gone. Whereas the wealth of a grain, you can go on and on. And being so Chinese, like I was brought up, grains and roots are so important. You go roots on and on, sun go on and on.
Grains and looks.
Roots. Because you need grains to take roots.
Okay.
Plant seeds. I mean, basically, it's seeds and roots. I think just whenever I see grains or seeds, to me, is any moral story about that is I've just been brought in school system just to talk about roots and talk about generation, talk about gratitude, talk about wealth.
Okay. Yeah. No, that's good that you mentioned that. There's a kind of a complex of ideas there. The grains is about roots. That's about something which is embedded in the ground. It's about prosperity, it's about passing things down through generations and so on. So there's the difference between grain and cattle is not just it's not just an arbitrary difference, but there's a whole different culture and different society and different worldview which is associated with these two things. Now in anthropology, this is actually one of the major features that you see down through the generations. Is a conflict between the pastoralists and the agriculturalists, right? In the Bible, Cain and Abel, right? Cain's a, I can't remember which one's which. Cain's a pastoral, he's a cattle pastoralist, and Abel's an agriculturalist, or it's the other way around, I can't remember. So they get in a fight. We think of Cain and Abel as being like two brothers, but it's actually it's the two farming systems in conflict is what it's about. And we see this again and again. Now, if we look back in Indian tradition, the Brahmanical tradition, the Vedic tradition, were originally pastoralists. Okay, they had horses, they had chariots, and they had cows. Okay, the word which it has here for cow is go. Okay, Pali word go, Sanskrit gava, which actually is a cognate with the English word cow. Okay, so cow and go are the same word. What does that tell us? That tells us that in the very, very ancient times, 2,000 or 3,000 BC, when the Aryan peoples moved from their homeland in the Caucasus or Russia, they already had cows and they were already a central part of their tradition. Okay, the word for grain, which he has here, is dhanya. Dhanya doesn't have any cognates in English. It's not related to the English word rice or the English word wheat or any of the other English words for grains. What does that tell us? Well, it tells us that it's only after they'd left their homeland and the Aryan people had gone to India in the south and to Europe in the west that they started growing their grains. So the ancient Aryan peoples were pastoralists. Now, think about what that means in terms of a lifestyle, okay? First thing is that you don't get settled. You're wandering, right? I mean, you don't have cattle pens and all those kinds of things. You wander across the countryside. They have horses that they would ride on and they would live in tents and so on, and they would move from place to place according to the season. And it's quite a hard lifestyle. And it's quite a kind of butch, you know, cowboy kind of thing, right? And you get this kind of feeling from a lot of the old Vedic verses and so on. It's all about, you know, yay, Indra, let's go and smite the enemy, let's kind of smash them and grab all their gold and stuff, and then we'll be even richer and we'll have lots more cows and sons and so on. So it's this very kind of aggressive energy, very kind of masculine energy. And so these kind of rootless people wandering across the country, wherever the pastures will grow, wherever they can feed. Now, of course, there's naturally a conflict with agriculturalists. Well, because first of all, you don't want cows coming and eating your bloody rice. Get out of here, you cows, right? And the pastoralists are always going to want to move, while the agriculturalists want to go and stay still, right? So it's from agriculture that you tend to get towns and then, of course, cities. And the only way that you can support a city or even a large town is through growing grains, because it's only through grains that you can store enough food to be able to last you to supply a city. So all of the higher civilizations, anything bigger than a village basically, has to be based on an agricultural, grain-based culture. So there's this kind of inherent tension. Now, when the Aryan peoples arrived in India, they came down through Afghanistan, modern-day Pakistan, and around about 1000 BC, so about 500 years before the Buddha, they coalesced. So we're talking about fairly disparate wandering peoples going here and there with a loose sort of cultural affinity, but no sort of defined political boundaries or structure. And they coalesced around about 1000 BC in the Kuru country. So that's approximately where modern-day Delhi is. So it's in the northwest of India. And that was where the first great Aryan kingdom was in India. The capital was Hastinapura. And that's when the Vedas were compiled in the form that we have it now. And it's from that time that the Aryan culture began to become a more settled culture, and that pastoral lifestyle began to be gradually phased out in favour of the more settled agricultural lifestyle, and because, and with all of the things that come with that, the being able to build cities, to set up permanent kind of roads, and all of the technologies and so on of civilization. So that was starting to happen a few hundred years before the Buddha, but even shortly before the Buddha, even 100 or 200 years before the Buddha, in the texts that we read in those times, there's still the cow is the basic unit of wealth. Okay, there's no money, The cow is the unit of wealth. Okay, so if you pay someone, you pay them in cows. Yeah, and cows, of course, are not too bad as a unit of wealth because you can move them around, right? Whereas you can't, grain is much harder. You can't pick up your field and then give it to somebody. As cattle, you can. So it's only in that time of the Buddha and around that time there was this great shift towards a money-based economy, towards an agricultural economy, towards an urban economy. Right? And so this, I think, is reflected here in the Buddha's verse. It was actually that was how I found out about this little sutta, because I was reading about these social changes. And they noted this particular passage where they had the Buddha kind of siding with the agriculturalists as opposed to the pastoralists. So why would the Buddha do that? Well, there might be a number of reasons. One would be that agriculture perhaps is less cruel, right? You don't have to kill. Well, you have to kill the grain, but you don't have to kill the cows. There's a kind of a myth in Indian history about this idea of the sacred cow, right? In India, you have the kind of the sacred cow these days, and everybody always assumes that everything in India has always been the same, which is simply untrue. In the time of the Buddha, there's no idea of a sacred cow, you very commonly meet the idea of a Goghataka as the cow killer, the butcher is called a Goghataka. So it's the killing of the cattle. But it certainly was part of... The other thing, I think, which is why the Buddha would side with the agrarian economy rather than the pastoralist economy is because the agricultural economy produces more reliable surpluses. Right? More reliable surpluses. And that's what the Sangha needs to survive. Right? That you can only have a community of spiritual people, right? Or monastics or ascetics or whatever, if there's enough productivity in the culture to have excess. Right? If people are just getting by, then you can't support a class of philosophers or spiritual seekers or whatever it might be. So this is one of the basic things, again, which allows a society to develop specialized trades and crafts of people who aren't just devoted to surviving and getting by. Yeah, that's how you can have specialization and so on in society, is because you have a surplus. Only a small group of people can produce enough food to feed everybody. Yeah? So I think this is perhaps one of the other things that the Buddha is getting to here. And I think that point that you raised earlier about the roots is also another one. The grain is also features a lot in Buddhist similes that the Buddha gave for like observing the cycles of birth, aging, and death. Yeah, and so you can see that the Buddha said, for example, that consciousness is like a seed. So you can see that there's this always getting reborn, these cycles of birth and aging and death. Okay, so yeah.
Thank you very much for your explanation, because it sort of resonates very deeply with how I understand Buddhism, at least how it can be possible, because before your explanation, I thought that it must be through the division of labor that we can have proper practice in Buddhism, because if we have to get everything ourselves, quite hard to keep the five precepts.
Yeah.
But if there's division of labor, then we can choose to divide and then we can keep it properly.
Right. Yep. Okay. I'm just hesitating because I'm not sure how we're getting on a bit in time. I had some other materials prepared, but I'm not sure if I can have time for them. Anyway, we'll just go on quickly now. There's no light like the sun. Now, of course, the fact that the sun is the greatest light is hardly is obviously fairly obvious. Sun worship, the worship of the sun as a deity, is a very important part of the Indian tradition, and we find that is embodied in many ways in the pre-Buddhist traditions. And it's quite interesting that this worship of the sun is sometimes adopted, like all of the religious ideas around the time of the Buddha, and the Buddha would sort of leave out things which were harsh or cruel or whatever, but he was quite happy to adopt and transform aspects which were suitable. And I might just give you one example of that. So this is a verse from a Jataka story called the Mora Jataka, or the Mahamora Jataka, the Jataka of the peacock. And so this Jataka is the story of a golden peacock. That's one of my favorite ones of the Jataka stories. The golden peacock himself is a symbol of the sun. I won't go into details why, but he clearly is. But one of the things that he's associated with is that the golden peacock sings for his own protection a set of verses every morning and every evening. And the verses he sings is, "There he rises, the king all-seeing, making all things bright with his golden light. I worship you, a glorious being, making all things bright with your golden light. Keep me safe, I pray, throughout the coming day." And so the golden peacock sings this verse every morning for his own protection. Now, in that verse, we have what's obviously a fairly straightforward sun worship and fairly, straightforward Brahmanism. The Brahmins every day would sing what they call the Gayatri mantra, which is a verse of homage to the sun. And the Gayatri mantra is still sung every day by the Brahmins in India. And the Gayatri mantra says something like, "Tatsavitur Varenyang," so homage to that glorious rising sun, Bhargo Devasya Dhima, whose divine radiance impels my mind, impels my consciousness towards awakening, something like that. In other words, it's a prayer to the sun, which is the brightness and the light of the sun is bringing wakefulness and knowledge and clarity to the mind. This is the Gayatri mantra, which is still recited every day by the Brahmins. And so this song here by the golden peacock is very similar. But the interesting thing about this in the Mora Jataka is that straight after the verse in homage to the sun, it then has a verse in homage to the arahants. All the arahants, the righteous, wise in the holy law, these do I honour and their aid implore. I pay honour to the awakened. I pay honour to freedom and to all that freedom has made free. So that second verse is purely a Buddhist verse, right? Homage to the arahants and to the Buddhas and to awakening and so on. And the first verse is purely Brahmanical, right? So this I thought that's a very good example of how the Buddhist tradition, you could just put one next to the other and it's not really a problem. You know, you can come out and you sing your homage to the sun and then you sing your homage to the arahants. That's all right. Yeah. And so that's right there in the Mahamora Jataka. So in the Indian tradition, in the old Vedas, the Adityas were the sun gods. Later on, Surya became very powerful as the god of the sun. It's still worshipped in India today. So in the Gayatri mantra, which I just mentioned, notice how that kind of moves from this homage to the divine radiance of the glorious sun. And then it brings awakening to my mind. And the word that it's using here for the mind is dhi, which is a very interesting word in the Vedas, dhi. The Pali word, which is descended from dhi, is jhana. Okay? So in jhana, the mind is filled with light. Yeah? And this is why this word jhana is gradually evolved to have this meaning of a profound state of meditation where the mind is filled with light. In the Vedic tradition, it has this idea of divine inspiration, especially associated with that rising sun. You wake up when the sun comes, your mind wakens, the clarity and knowledge comes to your mind. So this is how these things work, gradually evolving and shifting in meaning over the years. And so that shift from the external to the internal light, which is already implied in the Gayatri Mantra, is brought out fully explicitly here in the Buddha's response, where he says there is no light like wisdom. So it's not the external light which is important, it's the inner light which is important. And that's very characteristic of Buddhism, but you do find similar statements in the pre-Buddhist text as well. And the last one here, among the waters, the rain is supreme. Okay, so the Deva says, among the waters, the ocean is supreme. And the Buddha says, among the waters, the rain is supreme. Oh, this is a bit weird, isn't it? Why are the rains bigger than the oceans? And why is the Buddha saying that the rain is better than the ocean? I can see that there's a conflict between, say, the grain and the cattle. Okay, I can see that. But what's... The ocean's not much use to us, yeah? Yeah? Is the ocean really not much use to us? What happens if the ocean dried up? What would happen? We wouldn't last very long. But it is true that the rain is more directly useful. Yeah, the oceans just seem to sit there. Yeah. Anything else? Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah. Yeah. Any other thoughts on why the rain is better than the ocean? Can't drink the ocean water, yeah. Don't we have a desalination plant now? Sorry? It's the rain that fills the ocean. Okay, very good, yeah. Yeah. So that's another very important point, and that's... if we have a look at how these things are used and talked about, again, if the Deva is coming from the Brahmanical tradition, in the Brahmanical tradition, the ocean, remember that the ocean was conceived essentially as infinite, right? And essentially is fairly much static, okay? It's just an infinite, it doesn't have any boundaries to it, right? Not that people knew of in those days. And it just goes on forever and it's infinite in size. And it's always there, right? Of course, according to Buddhist cosmology, it dries up eventually, but basically it's always there. And in the Hindu, in the Upanishads, in the pre-Buddhist philosophy, you find a lot of similes. For example, it says that things like, just as every river has its own name and shape, its own nama and rupa, but when they go into that great ocean, they lose their individual names and shapes and they become one with the great ocean. Yeah? And so too, according to the Brahmanical philosophy, this individual self, this Atman here, is the same as that cosmic Brahman. We all have our individual bodies, our individual names and so on, but eventually we become one with that Brahman, which is the cosmos, which is the world. Tattvangasi, thou art that. This is a Brahmanical philosophy which was around before the Buddha came. And so that ocean was felt as a symbol, a very powerful symbol of that kind of infinite Brahman, the infinite consciousness from which one has arisen and to which one will return. Okay? Yeah, so this idea, we rise out of the ocean and we will go back to it. And ultimately we're nothing more than just a name and a shape which is given to part of that. And this is a very strong idea that's found before the time of the Buddha. What the Buddha pointed out was exactly this idea, was that the ocean isn't in fact something which is just there, permanent, right? It's conditioned, and the ocean itself is filled up by the rivers, and it's the rivers which condition the ocean, yeah? And it's the rains which fill up the rivers. And we find many similes of this form in the Buddhist scriptures, just like the rains fall on the great mountains and they fill up the little creeks, and the creeks fill up the small rivers fill up the great rivers, and the great rivers fill up the great ocean, and that is how the great ocean comes to be full. So the Buddha always looked at, rather than looking at something as being this kind of infinite mass of like an ocean from which one arises and to which one returns, he looked at it in terms of conditionality. There's a process, a flow of moving on from one to the other. And the important thing is to look, well, what's the cause? What lies behind things? So the ocean, in a sense, is like the result. That's where everything goes to. So what the Buddha wanted to look at is, where do things come from? Yeah, what's the source of things? And so, of course, the source of things is from the sky and the rain. Of course, we know that this is all part of a greater cycle, right? The clouds themselves come from the ocean and they go around. So it's not saying that it was not meant in a sort of absolute literal physical sense, but just in a general sense, the rains come from the sky as the source and come to the ground and fill the rivers and fill the oceans. So I think this is what the Buddha is getting to when he's saying that the rain is supreme. And those practical examples that were mentioned earlier, I think, are also relevant. I mean, the rain fills the rivers. This is how we drink. This is how the grain is grown. This is how people can survive and so on. So it has a very practical sense as well. But it also has that more kind of subtle spiritual sense that we should be looking to the causes of things rather than to the results or to the effects of them. So I actually had a few more texts and bits and pieces prepared, but that's probably enough for today, because I did want to talk a bit about the early Buddhism course, so I shouldn't go on for too long about that. So hopefully that's given some clarity for this one, and this particular sutta is unusually so, I think, embedded very closely in the culture, the time and the place at the time of the Buddha, and is best understood in terms of the social changes which were taking place and which the Buddha was right in the middle of. The change from a pastoral economy to an agrarian economy, from a rural to an urban economy, and the increasing density of population, the new technologies of iron and so on, which were necessary for ploughing the fields. And all of these kind of shifts which were part of what how Buddhism was formed, the culture, the ideas, the values, the institutions. Why were they able to have support a sangha? Why was there enough surplus in society? All of these kinds of things. And these are the social conditions which made it possible for Buddhism to arise at that time and that place. And so I think it's kind of interesting that that this sutta kind of, even though it's very short, still reflects those conditions, I think, very precisely in quite an unusual way. So that's the little discussion of the none equal to that of a son sutta. I hope that's been of some enjoyment for you. Any questions before we finish up?
That there were perfect conditions at that time. I was thinking the other day, surely now is perfect conditions because of the internet and such things. I wondered why historically that those great teachers occurred at that time rather than now through mass communication.
Okay. Well, I don't know about perfect conditions, but certainly it made it possible in a way that it wasn't before. One of the changes that did happen at that time, which goes along with all of those cultural changes is the rise of what we would consider today to be introspection. And I think this is actually something I didn't go into in too much detail, but this idea there's no affection like that for oneself. That's an expression of an introspective and reflective capacity. Yeah, to say that there's no affection like that of a son, you know, that's very obvious. It's very kind of external, that kind of that love that you have for the son. But then when you start to look at yourself, you start to turn that inwards and say, "What am I?" Then this is something which is very important, and this is something which had become the defining theme of the philosophy in the centuries, 100 or 200 years before the Buddha. And so the Buddha himself still did that. Right? He's still looking at, well, who am I, what am I doing? It's very introspective nature of Buddhism, but without turning that into a metaphysical theory of the self. And so that shift to be much more introspective is also very characteristic of that period. And so it's interesting that in that time, you know, that there are all of these conditions which were there for the Buddha to arise, and those conditions are quite unusual. You know, it's not common that you find, you know, that a fertile place and the social conditions and cultural conditions and the philosophical condition and all of those things there, that's going to be good for the arising of the Buddha. As to whether ancient India is better than today, I don't know, maybe not. I wasn't there, I can't say. Before the Aryans came to India.
Did they bring that with them?
Yeah, that question is, there's no real answer to that. Generally speaking, the historians say that the Aryans probably gradually moved into India in the sort of early to middle part of the second millennium BC, so around 1700 to 1500 BC was when they first started to come into India. There's no, for example, there's no meditative or cultural aspects in, say, Greek culture or the other Aryan cultures, which are also descended from the old Aryans. And in the Rig Veda, the oldest Aryan scripture, there's very little. But there are some things, even in the Rig Veda, there are some things which are a bit reflective, like the Gayatri Mantra, which I just said. And, you know, some images which are very, I think, very suggestive. One image, for example, you find in the Rig Veda, it says just like there were two birds sitting on a branch, one of the birds eating the fruit and the other one just watches over without eating. Yeah? I really love that image. This is Ajahn Brahm's the doer and the knower, right? Yeah, the bird is eating the fruit and the other bird's just watching. It's not getting involved. And these kinds of images about just watching and just knowing are already there in the Aryan culture. And one of the things that's interesting is that a lot of the words for knowledge and seeing are common in the Indo-Aryan languages. So, for example, English words like visual, video, wit, yeah, witch, as in the flying on broomstick variety. Okay, witch is an Indo-European word. The roots of it just meaning a person of knowledge. Yeah, someone who has the sacred knowledge. Yeah, is equivalent to the Pali vidya. Words like the word to know, for example, is an Indo-European root, and so on. So there's many roots from those ideas of knowing and seeing, which are common in that tradition. So it suggests that there was already somehow that emphasis on the mind and thought and reflection was already there in the Aryan culture. As far as meditation goes specifically, many people look to the native Indian cultures, the Indus Valley culture, where you find pictures of deities in yoga postures even before the Aryans came, so about 3000 BC. So perhaps from a combination of the Aryan culture and the local Indian shamanic culture that the meditation arose. And drugs, I should say. And drugs, yeah. Yeah, there's lots of. One of the main deities is King Soma, who's like a, probably a magic mushroom or something like that. Yeah, so that's the other place where meditation came from. Yeah. Oh, we've got some questions. Okay. Okay. Thank you very much. Okay, so this is a question about the early Buddhism course, so we should probably, unless there's any more questions on that. No? All right. Okay, so now, for some time I've wanted to do a more structured approach to looking at the Buddha's teachings, and particularly the teachings of what we call early Buddhism. And early Buddhism basically is a word that scholars use to mean the Buddhism that the Buddha taught, basically. I've had some discussions with Ajahn Brahmali about this, and we've put together a course. Now, this course is a one-day workshop, okay, once a month for 6 months. Okay, so it's 6 one-day workshops over a 6-month period. For each workshop, there'll be readings beforehand, and I tried to arrange it so there'd be about an hour or two of reading per week. Okay, so for people who register for the course, they'll have to do about an hour or two of reading per week, roughly. And the workshop, during the day in the workshop, will be a mixture of teachings, meditations, small group discussions, and so on. So we're going to keep it quite varied during the day. We don't want to get people too bored just kind of sitting there talking the whole time. And there's also be meditations, so that we'll be assigning different meditations for each month based on the particular teachings that are going to be going on. So the idea is that if you do that course, then at the end of the 6 months, you'll have a good idea of the background that the Buddha came up in, the culture and society in India at the time, what he taught, how it is that we know what he taught. And particularly what I'm interested to try to share and to try to communicate is how to find the methods and the means to find out answers for yourself. Yeah? So you don't have to always keep on bothering me with all your questions, okay? So this is the answer, is to learn the means of researching and understanding in the context. Yeah, I mean, things like that little sutta which we read today, if you just picked up that sutta and you looked at it, you probably wouldn't really sort of get it until you know something about the background. Yeah, so learning something about the background is, I think, very important. So hopefully by doing this 6-month course, then we can share that ability for people to do that. Now, I've done a course program here, and I've got a few copies if you want to have a look at it. There should be some more over in the office. One of the things which I wanted to discuss with you this weekend was about timing, and because potentially the course may well clash with this class, okay, so I wanted to bring that up with you and then see what we wanted to do about that. Because it's a one-day course, we're thinking of doing it. It's actually proving to be a little bit difficult to squeeze it in with all the other activities that are happening here at Nolimara on a weekend. But at the moment, we haven't decided. It has the dates on here, but since we did this, we realised there's some difficulties with the dates. So don't take the dates too seriously. They'll be on the website soon. Basically, it looks like at the moment we have two options. One is that we do it on a Saturday, so it'll be on the fourth Saturday of each month, starting next month, okay? And it'll be the timing will be from about 8:30 till 5 o'clock, okay? So we come in at 8:30, some teachings, meditations, and so on, break, and we have the dana, and then we come back and do some more and finish up around 5 o'clock. So it'll either be that on a Saturday or on the fourth Sunday in the afternoon until the evening, We can't do it in the morning because they have a Sunday school. So if we started, say, at 12:30 and went through to about 7 in the evening on a Sunday, but I'm not sure how that would be, whether people would be happy to do that, or which of those two arrangements do you think would be better? So I just wanted to throw this out, get some feedback, see if anybody has any thoughts or ideas. Saturday sounds better, do you think? Saturday? Okay, well, that seems to be fairly unanimous. Thanks, Lynn. That's good. Okay, good. Sunday? Okay, so we have 3 Sundays. Ooh. So you're a Sunday? Sunday. Ooh, okay. That's the next question, which I was going to look at, okay, was what we then do with relation to the sutta class, yeah. So that looks like it's somewhat evenly divided between Saturdays and Sundays. Oh, this is the democratic process in action. We've got a filibuster. Okay, so we now have to go around and pay people to vote for us. Okay. If it was to be on, like, for those people who sound like they might be interested, obviously, you know, it's the early days yet, but if you think you might be interested, would it be, if it was on the day of those days that you didn't want, would that make it impossible for you to come? Like, if you want it to be on Sunday, would Saturday be impossible, or vice versa? No? So... Right, yeah, there's various things on the Saturday which would have to be adjusted to make it fit in, and this is one of the reasons why originally we wanted to have it on the Sunday. Yeah, so at the moment, if I just get that feedback for you, so the feedback seems to be that basically some prefer one, some prefer the other, but it's not going to be a... Cherry's looking a bit... Yeah. On Sundays, people like to spend time with families. Uh-huh. Okay. Yeah. There's no light, no night public transport. Is that right? Sorry? Okay, so there's less transport, especially if you're going home late on a Sunday night, yeah? I mean, it won't be that late, but it'll be a little bit later. Okay. Yeah, we could do a transport roster, yeah. Okay, So it seems that there's a slight shift towards a Saturday. Okay, it still has to be determined just to make sure it works with the organisation, because it does mean we'll have to adjust a number of other things on the Saturday if we have it. For example, the meditation afternoon, maybe the meditation can go over into the community hall or something like that for that day. So these things we can probably figure our way around them. But okay, so that's one thing. Second thing was what was brought up is what's the relation between the early Buddhism course and the sutta class. Now, the reason I brought it up with you is because I assumed that a reasonable number of the people here would at least be interested to do the early Buddhism course if it was on. But I don't know whether that means that you'd like to just do the early Buddhism course and not do the sutta classes, or whether you'd like to do them both, or whether you'd like to maybe, because the early Buddhism course is normally on the fourth Sunday and the sutta class is usually the second and fourth, so we could maybe just do the sutta class on the second and then the early Buddhism course on the fourth, or we could shift the sutta classes to the first and third, right? So we still keep just as many sort of classes? Because obviously some people might not be able to come to the full day workshop, right? So they might still want to keep going with just the afternoon sort of class. So I just sort of throwing that out there, and again, just to get some feedback as to what generally you think would be the best way to do that. For the early Buddhism course? Okay. Okay, well, you can read this to get the details. But the six workshops, the first workshop, is looking at the background to the idea of early Buddhism, how the scholars have approached this teaching, how the Buddhist traditions see early Buddhism, and what are the sources. The second workshop is looking more at the details of the early Buddhist texts, the suttas in the different versions, so exploring what texts there are available, what sources there are available, what the relationship is between them, and so on. The third workshop, oh, this is not in the right order, number three, and then the next three is arranged according to Sila, Samadhi, Panya, so ethics, meditation and wisdom. So that's some of the main topics, the content of the teachings of early Buddhism. And then the last one is looking at the practical application, so how that early Buddhism relates to what we're doing today. Okay? So that's a very brief overview of the course. But as I said, there's a fairly substantial amount of reading to be done each week. It's not a huge amount, but that is an important part of it. If you want to come for the course, we're going to put something on the website. I told PJ's doing the website, I said you have to put something that says when you apply for register for the course, you have to register, okay? You can't just show up. You have to register and you have to tick a box that says, I will do the reading before each course. Okay? Yeah. Then if you don't have a computer, then you're stuffed, basically, yeah. Well, you can get the thing here. No, you should be able to find the things in the library here. Yeah. Yep. Definitely, I want people to come for everyone. Obviously, not everybody can come for everyone. But yeah, you know, you should commit to basically to coming as much as possible. Yeah. Oh, okay, yeah. So look, you know, if people have to miss out one or maybe two, then that's okay. But if it's more than that, it's probably a bit much. Yeah. Again, because I do want to be able to build it up in a structured way, and so we sort of rely on people having the information from the first workshops. So this is, I think, this is quite an important component. So, yep, Lynn. Yeah, it shouldn't be a problem as far as we're concerned. Usually what will happen is that either Ajahn Brahmali or myself or both will come down to do the early Buddhism course, and that will probably be, we'll basically keep that distinct from everything else. So no matter who's doing the Friday night talk or whatever, we'll just come down and teach that and then go back. So it shouldn't really affect, I mean, sometimes we might do the Friday night talk or whatever while we're here, but we're not trying to coordinate that. So it shouldn't really affect things. And you know, I think that the Sangha kind of likes teaching suttas anyway, so that's not really a problem. Okay, that's another question which I was going to come to you, but the quick answer will be yes. We'll record it and put that. Yeah. Sure. Yeah. Yep. Yeah. So if you, as I said, we, you know, really try to encourage people to come to all of the classes, but if you have to miss one or two, then we'll make it available. And that answers the question of Rudity, I'm not sure, from Latvia. Anyway, hello, Latvia. who asked about whether it's going to be broadcasted live. I think we might record them and put them up rather than broadcasting them live, because it's probably a bit of like question and answer and things, so probably some things that maybe want some editing. But that's not completely decided. But anyway, it will be put on the web in some form or another. Okay. Yep. No, $60 for the course. Yeah. Yeah, so that's a facility fee for the use of the Buddhist library. Yeah. That's right, yeah, it's $10 a day. Yeah, it's basically just to cover the electricity costs and stuff for the Buddhist library. Yeah. No, there'll be no charge for the one in Perth. Yeah, that's because Perth people are much more spiritually advanced. Yes. Yeah. Oh, the Easter weekend. From February, beginning, it's the fourth weekend from February. Which weekend is Easter? Easter is the 29th of March. What have we got? Yeah. Oh, sorry, it says the last Sunday. It should be the fourth Sunday. That's actually a mistake on here. I think there might be five, is there? Because this is March the 24th anyway. It's the weekend before Easter. Okay. Okay, so I think... Sure, yeah, yeah. Well, we'll double check that and make sure it doesn't clash with Easter. Okay. Yeah, yeah, sure. Yes, you're right. The May one is at the moment is Vaisak, which we've already become aware of that. We're going to have to change that one as well. Yeah, we've already changed that, so it's a little bit up in the air at the moment. So we'll thank you for letting us know about the Easter. I didn't think about Easter. Okay. We'll just make sure of that. Okay. Okay, so it looks like we have a preference for a Saturday rather than a Sunday. It seems to be the general gist of things. We have to confirm that with the Buddhist Society, but we'll see whether we can do that. As far as the Sutta class, what should we do? Should we continue the Sutta class, or if most people are going to be at the early Buddhism course, is there only going to be two or three showing up for the Sutta class, or is it going to be... What do you reckon? Sorry? Is the Sutta class on first and third? Yeah? Any other suggestions? Okay. All right. So the class should carry on? Okay. Okay. I know, yeah, it is always better to keep things consistent. Stick as it is, not change. Okay. Any other suggestions? Yeah. Yeah. Well, that's. I mean, that's true. That was also. Yeah. I do not understand at all. Yeah, you can't accommodate anyone. I think you just have to make a decision. You can't, if you do it like that, it becomes too confusing because some people might only be able to do one or the other, so they register, and they don't know if they can register. Yeah. That's right. You can't fit everyone. Okay, but still, this is why we're getting that feedback. So the general feeling that I'm getting is that people would prefer to keep the sutta class going for as it is, if we can. Okay, if we can, if necessary, maybe we might shift it to the first and third. But if we can keep it on the second and fourth. I think that's maybe preferable just for the sake of consistency. So we'll have the early Buddhism course on the Saturday, the fourth Saturday, and keep the sutta classes on the second and fourth as they have been. Does that sound reasonable? Okay. Okay. So there's also various retreats. So look, we can't adjust for everything. Yeah, there's all kinds of things happening. So look, if you're going on retreat, then good on you. Have a nice retreat. that's forgivable. You won't forget the Dhamma while you're on retreat, so it's okay. That's right. I'll probably be roped in for something. Yeah, this is actually one of the reasons why Atam Brahmali and I are teaching it together. So if either one of us can't do it that week or that month, then the other one can take over. Yeah. Yes, then. The reason for registering is to make sure that people actually come and they actually commit themselves for the full course, so they just don't just kind of casually show up and then disappear. When you register, you will have to tick a box that says, I'm going to come if I can, you know, at all make it. And, yeah, obviously death and some other things are going to be... But I honestly don't see why death should stand in the way. I think that... Personally, I feel that it's wrong to think that zombies and ghosts can't practice Dhamma. But anyway... I don't know. I think there'll be enough. Yeah, the one we've done in Sydney. I mean, Sydney at the Buddhist Library has a much smaller sort of membership base than here, and we very quickly got about 40 more people to come for the course. So that's basically full up there. So I don't think that should be a problem. Okay, so. Yeah, so that's basically the reason for registration. So everyone knows that it's a course that they're committed to. They should do the reading and the practices, and they should come, if at all possible, to each one of the workshops. Yeah. Early Buddhism 101. Where and when do we sign? You sign online. Those of you who don't have any... I'm sure we can probably get some registration forms on the front desk. We'll try to organise that. No, thanks for mentioning that. We'll try to organise that from next week if we can finalise the details. Yeah. Yeah. This is just the course outline. Registration sheet is there. Okay, well, we haven't even... Ah, okay, sign up for interest, okay. So, so that shouldn't be a problem. So that's the dates and times. So I will have to confirm that we can do it on the Saturday, but I think that should be all right. I think that's about it. All right? Okay, very good. This shouldn't be exciting, it should be tranquilizing. Anyway.